Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Trump White House presses threat to close U.S.-Mexico border this week, and Donald Trump toughens his stance on Central America. President Trump threatened to close the southern border this week if Mexico does not, quote, immediately stop, end quote, what he calls the surge of illegal immigrants coming into the United States. Quote, we have right now two big caravans coming up from Guatemala, massive caravans walking right through Mexico, end quote. Also, the United States is halting humanitarian funding to Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. The State Department confirmed this on Saturday. First, let's listen to the president.
Mexico is making absolutely a fortune with the United States. They have a trade surplus of over $100 billion, which is far bigger than anybody understands. They've had it for many years, and either they're going to stop. They have the strongest immigration laws anywhere in the world. And we have the weakest, the most pathetic laws. Number one, Congress has to act. And number two, Mexico, they make so much money from the United States and so many other things, so many other assets. They have to grab it and they have to stop it. We have right now two big caravans coming up from Guatemala, massive caravans walking right through Mexico. So Mexico's tough. They can stop them, but they chose not to. Now they're going to stop them. And if they don't stop them, we're closing the border. They'll close it. And we'll keep it closed for a long time. I'm not playing games. Mexico has to stop it. They have people coming right through Mexico. It's a long, very dangerous journey. Mexico sends buses. They send trucks. They do absolutely. They started at one point a little bit stopping. They don't do anything to stop it right now. So the caravans form. I've ended payments to Guatemala, to Honduras, and to El Salvador. Oh, no money goes there anymore. We were giving them $500 million. We were giving them tremendous aid. We stopped payment.
What does this really mean, and are these solutions really just looking for problems? For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He heads the Garcia and Garcia Law Firm San Antonio office with a full-time focus on immigration law. He is Carlos Castaneda. Carlos, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Well, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So let me just start with a general question. Your thoughts when you heard the president making these allegations, accusations, these basic statements about this massive caravan that's walking right through Mexico. What are your thoughts?
It's very interesting that it happens around this time, actually, because just in the past week or so, we have seen a slow ramp up on what is informally called the Remain in Mexico policy, also known as the Migration Policy Protocols, which is a little known policy that was started a few months ago that has the goal of having people fight their asylum cases while waiting outside the United States. And a reminder, listeners, that an asylum seeker by law is someone who has already entered the United States and therefore has their case being processed through the immigration courts of the United States, which is to be distinguished from what officially is called a refugee, someone who is seeking the same goal but is processing their case from outside the country, often through a refugee camp, maybe by a UN camp located in some part of the world.
So if I understand what you're saying, there's been, and I've been seeing reports on the news about folks getting to Mexico, then taking up temporary residency, and I'll use that word very, very liberally, at camps and other places, and are working through offices on the Mexico side of the border to have, well, first of all, to get the information that they need in order to understand how to proceed, and then they're working on the Mexico side of the border instead of coming across the border to the United States. Is that what you're saying?
It's getting closer there. The thing that I'm trying to get at with my mention of the ramp-up of the Remain in Mexico policy is that the only way that policy works is if Mexico cooperates. And if the U.S. president is saying that I'm going to go down hard on Mexico, I'm going to close the entire U.S.-Mexico border to hurt Mexico, at the same time that he is depending on the Mexican government itself for help in making this little-known policy that's still in its infancy ramp up, that is one of the great ironies that you're seeing here. And again, with comments that he has made, as well as the cutting off of aid from the Golden Triangle countries of Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, is being made more as a reactionary series of policies to what is happening in the news, which is right now these two major caravans leaving Central America and making their way through Mexico.
Are we seeing an uptick in those two groups, those seeking asylum and those economic individuals, those that are coming here just looking for work, because we're getting into spring and we're getting into the time of planting and we're also working now towards, in certain crops, harvesting? Is this kind of the natural cycle of immigration?
I would not call this so much a natural cycle of immigration, even though we do have a decrease when it comes to the winter season, just because, well, it's less nice to try to do the dangerous journey, especially through the deserts of Arizona when it's winter than in other times of the year, unless it's the heat of the summer. In this situation, because what we're seeing is many individuals, often family groups, and walking in an organized way, I would say that this is different than what we generally would expect. Having said that, in terms of the number of people coming, this is still, despite all the hype around it, lower than the numbers that we have seen even in the early 2000s.
So as the president talks about closing the border, What does that really mean? As an attorney, what does that really mean? Because when I look at the economic impact that his closing the border, if in fact that's what he's actually trying to do, something as simple as tomatoes, 87% of tomatoes, as I understand it, that come in the country come from Mexico. That's the import side. On the export side, I think 22% of our pork products go to Mexico. So what is he really talking about when he talks about closing the border?
I'll tell you exactly what he's talking about. We're talking about blowing smoke, quite frankly. You ask my opinion as an attorney, and as an attorney, my job, for the benefit of my clients and I suppose my own sanity, is to cut through what is political rhetoric and what is really indications of actual policies. And that's why when we started this interview, I wanted to start off with the initiation of one of the tangible new policies that for me is interesting and worrisome to an extent, because that is something that we see that is concrete. And as you mentioned, the economic repercussions on both countries, and especially in my part of the country here in Central Texas, would be tremendous if there really were a shutdown in the border, by which I would interpret as stopping the flow of goods, services, and people. And we're not just talking about things rolling in trucks from Mexico or from the United States. There's also a lot of energy sharing in the border. For example, transfers of natural gas from Texas to Mexico, the port side of things, transfers of oil to be refined in the Houston area or Louisiana area refineries in order to be used by Mexican consumers or other consumers. All of that would be, in theory, ground to the halt if we did have a total shutdown of international trade between both countries, even if at just the land borders.
You talk about being in Texas. If he closes the border, you have ports such as Laredo, Texas, that handle more U.S. exports than any of the 450 airports, seaports, and border crossings in the nation. In 2018, almost $235 billion in exports and imports crossed through Laredo, Texas. 37% of the U.S. total with Mexico goes through Laredo. What type of impact would that have in Texas if the president were to close the border?
In a nutshell, a major, tremendous impact. And I would say not that long-lasting one, but seriously one with the major repercussions on the businesses that depend on the import-export trade. Because if there's that massive slowdown, you have changes in terms of insurance conduct, you would change in terms of consumer expectations and also supplier expectations in terms of those companies that rely on either the products being exchanged there or on the transportation networks being used in order to transport products or services across the border.
Talk now about the president's decision to halt, of all things, humanitarian funding to Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. You have families that are walking hellacious miles seeking asylum and running from gang violence and running from oppression, running from economies that the U.S. has wreaked havoc upon, and he wants to halt humanitarian funding. Well, all that really would seem to me to do would be to exacerbate the situation. It wouldn't mitigate the situation.
Indeed, and certainly not mitigating the situation by any means. And the idea that a country's government can simply turn on or off the faucet of their own nationals who are making the decision, not lightly made, to travel to the United States and try to make their lives here in the U.S. is somewhat ridiculous, the idea that a government can just turn on and off what their own people's decisions are. So that in itself is, again, blowing political smoke. And therefore, I don't see it as, shall we say, something that is going to really affect too much the lives of my clients, for instance, who, by and large, I would say they would not change their decision to come to the United States or not based on that decision. But certainly, it does not do anything constructive.
One of the rationales that has been assigned to the president's policy, and there are some within the administration that have admitted that this, is, in fact, was the policy, was making things incredibly harsh to act as a deterrence. Have you seen, you've mentioned your clients a couple of times in this interview, have you seen the United States policy as it relates to those trying to seek asylum in the United States from Mexico, from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador? Are you seeing an effect, a deterrent effect?
There is certainly many deterrent type policies. I still see many people coming in despite that. In part, it's a matter of just knowing that the grass is greener on this side and they're going to basically chance it to see if they can fight their case here in the United States and possibly stay, usually with support of a family member or a close friend who they can seek for assistance here. And so I wouldn't say that as of now the deterrent policies have really changed people's mind yet. It's not at that stage yet. But certainly myself as an attorney, it has made it harder to get, shall we say, clear-cut victories for people who are eligible to get an immigration-related victory based on current immigration laws.
Are the people that are coming, are they still able to find employment when they get here? And if so, do you have any general idea? Give me the two or three. I've got some stereotypes that come to mind. Could you give me the two or three main areas where people that are coming to this country seeking asylum are finding employment?
Sure. I can speak as to the Texas area. Number one, for males especially, it's construction jobs. Also, putting up housing, painting, that kind of matter, manual labor of that sort, that would be number two. For women, domestic work, shall we say, cleaning hotels or other places, that is definitely something that is very common among many of the clients that I do have. That certainly is not the sole kind of industry that they are in, but this is one, shall we say, stereotype that is supported by some, shall we say, at least anecdotal evidence that I have seen in many of my clients here in the Texas area.
I'm originally from California, and so the stereotype that comes to mind for me is agriculture and the picking of fruit and produce. Are those jobs still going unfilled, or because of the years of individuals coming to this country to do that work, are migrants now having to find other sectors for employment instead of, again, the stereotypical stoop labor, agricultural type of work? Does that question make sense?
It does. Now, I cannot speak as to what I've seen with my clients as to how frequent the agricultural a job is taken up, but certainly many undocumented persons continue in agriculture. I know that for a fact. Mm-hmm. And I would say that the ability of many individuals to go into the kinds of industries that I previously mentioned stems from the demand for labor in those areas. In Texas, we still have a relatively hot construction and a housing market, and so those jobs that I mentioned are in high demand, and the desire for such labor is high, and therefore the availability of such work is such that it attracts many individuals who are undocumented to that area, which in general, at least in the construction bit, is more high-paying than many jobs that you might generally think of, especially agriculture. So if I were someone who came and found an ample construction market in demand for someone like myself, and that paid more than the, as you said, agricultural stoop labor, I would definitely go for the former.
You know,
and we've seen that happening.
And as I listen to the presidential campaign and listening to a lot of those who are vying for the Democrat nominee, they're talking about infrastructure spending. And you've been talking about construction and home building. And if a great bit of the budget actually goes towards infrastructure building, road construction, bridge construction and refitting and all those areas, I could see the market for labor going through the roof in this country because there won't be enough of the indigenous population to fill those jobs.
I've been thinking of very similar things as I hear many candidates talking about investments in infrastructure. I have actually had such things go through my mind, not so much because it's in my area as a professional, as an attorney, but because it just rings true to me as one of the natural effects of such federal government investments.
You know, one of the areas that this show, we're in Washington, D.C., and so crab picking and seafood processing is huge, particularly in the Maryland area and Virginia area. And last year, people were amazed at the price of processed crab meat and how expensive processed crab meat had become. And what people didn't realize was because there was not the migrant labor to do the crab picking and the crab meat processing, a lot of that work went unfilled. A lot of the demand for crab went unfilled. And crab meat, the price of crab meat went through the roof.
Mm-hmm. I'm not surprised. That's economics 101.
And just a very simple example for people who listen to the rhetoric of the president and don't really understand the practical applications of the very people that he's railing about in this crisis narrative that he is creating, the impact that it can have on your table or in your soup tureen on a very fundamental basic level.
For sure.
Particularly when it comes to the money that's being withheld from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, how do you see this playing out?
Well, the absence of the money is going to hurt the governments of those countries. Overall, it's not going to make a significant change in the migration patterns, according to what I'm seeing here.
Okay.
What I do think, though, is that as a reaction of the oncoming caravan making its way through Mexico, I do think that the ramp-up in, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to go back to this, the Remain in Mexico policy, mm-hmm. which, again, only started out in a small port of entry in California, between San Diego and Yuma, Arizona, for that context, but just last week started out in the El Paso area, and there are plans to make this broader. I have a feeling that just maybe in a couple of weeks we will be discussing the use of that policy on a mass scale throughout several sectors of the border and whether or not that is a legally valid exercise of presidential authority.
Okay. Carlos Castaneda, thank you for that projection, and we'll stay tuned, and we know who to call when that becomes the issue. Greatly, greatly appreciate your time, as always, your contribution to The Critical Hour.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Carlos. All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Silencing the Whistle, The Intercept Shutters Snowden Archive, Citing Cost. This is from Mint Press News. Back in March, First Look Media announced that it was shutting down access to Edward Snowden's massive trove of leaked National Security Agency documents. The Intercept, which is owned by First Look Media, has maintained a research team to handle the large number of documents provided by Snowden to Intercept journalists Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald. First Look CEO Michael Bloom said, quote, "It is our hope that Glenn and Laura will be able to find a new partner, such as an academic institution or research facility, that will continue to report on and publish the documents in the archive consistent with the public interest," end quote. With that, I wanted to take a moment and discuss the need for and power of independent journalists and, more importantly, investigative journalists, because an informed electorate is the cornerstone to a democracy. So, for insight into this issue, I turn to one of the best that I know. As an investigative journalist, his life's work has been dedicated to uncovering and highlighting the inequities and injustices in American democracy. He fearlessly speaks to the issues that mainstream corporate media refuse to address, such as the vote fraud in the 2000 presidential election and the impact that Kris Kobach's cross-check program played in suppressing votes in 2016. He is Greg Palast. Greg, as always, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Glad to be with you, Wilmer.
So, to level set the conversation, well, first of all, your thoughts on the Greenwald story, The Intercept, and their decision now to save money to basically shut down the Snowden archive.
Okay. The Intercept is owned by Pierre Omidyar, who is personally worth well north of $10 billion. He pays Glenn Greenwald as an editor in years over $500,000 a year. And, you know, you have fantastic salaries paid by a billionaire. And suddenly, maintaining the Snowden files is suddenly a massive financial burden. And the person entrusted with those files originally, Laura Poitras, who took the Snowden files and gave them and shared them with Glenn Greenwald, that, you know, she doesn't believe this for a minute. These people are literally rich beyond imagination, that suddenly they can't spend something which is the entire research department is 1% of their operation. So, you know, we don't know what's going on. There's some, you know, there may have to do with Omidyar's political interest. One of the dangers of that happened, there was a great fear that turning over the documents to this billionaire Omidyar was privatizing this important source of investigative reporting, which may be happening here. I don't have all the inside. I mean, I don't, you know, like, but it smells funny that this multi-billionaire and this ultra-rich website suddenly can't maintain some computer files and spend some time to go through them. Now, I do note the Washington Post has shut down their Snowden files. They had a chunk of them, et cetera. But I have to say that we know why the Washington Post did that. That's controlled by the billionaire Bezos, who does not want any more embarrassing material to come out about, whether it was material from the Clinton administration, Obama administration, et cetera. He's politically connected, and that remains very important to him. So we expected the Washington Post to make a political decision to shut down its Snowden files. So this is dangerous stuff. Investigative reporting, the way we work is we get the inside dope. We get the documents they want to hide from you. We have it's our government of, by, and for the people. It's not their secrets. It's our information. And in the case of Snowden, we uncovered the proof of what we'd suspected for long, that the government was spying on Americans and on a mass basis without any evidence that you and I are criminals, and abusing that information. And this is like, it's very deeply disturbing, especially because the guy who's basically put his life on the line, who's basically living in exile, Ed Snowden,
he was not consulted in what would happen to his information. And that's betraying a whistleblower. Again, I don't know all the information, but the idea that Omidyar suddenly run out of a couple shekels to pay for this file is ridiculous. So I'll make them an offer. The Palace Investigative Fund, the not-for-profit foundation, will take the material and we'll handle it from here. Just turn it over. We will have the get the funds. I don't think that will be a problem, and we'll take over. So, Glenn, if it's too much of a burden for you, just hit the send button. I'll take it.
To level set the conversation, and you just touched on this a bit, but quickly explain the difference between what you do as an investigative journalist and what so many others don't do in mainstream American media.
Well, let's put it, what I do is reporting. What you usually get in America, especially, is repeating. Now, Glenn Greenwald and I both worked for The Guardian, which is, by the way, a not-for-profit newspaper out of Britain, as is BBC Television, which is citizen-owned. It's not actually owned by the government, by the way, which is why it tends to be fairly independent. And one thing we do know is that we hunt out. I spent my time at The Guardian and at BBC, as I do today, blasting out those secret files, those secret documents. For example, I'm the guy that got those secret documents from inside Catherine Harris's office saying, you know, which targeted the list of black people targeted for removal in the 2000 election. And by the way, this week, I was just looking at, just before our conversation, Wilmer, I was looking at documents just sent to me by the office of former Secretary of State, now Governor Brian Kemp, the list of the people he illegally purged from the voter rolls of Georgia. I was just looking at those lists that I received from them. In that case, sometimes I get them from insiders. Sometimes I use all kinds of fun tricks to get these inside documents. In this case, I had some major law firms sue the state of Georgia to get those secret files that should be public of the people who were wrongly removed from the voter rolls. And I'm looking at lists right now of hundreds of thousands of Georgians, mostly voters of color, who removed because they supposedly left the state of Georgia, but they didn't. This was not reported by a single mainstream media outlet. And it's not that they didn't know about it. The New York Times called me. In fact, I was at the New York Times in their offices. But they're still not reporting this story, even though we literally have the names of the people who were wrongly removed. But I did give this information to all candidates. I gave it to Brian Kemp. He pulled off this trick, but I said, here's your list of people you removed. Explain it. And to his opponent, Stacey Abrams, she looked at the list, and she has not conceded the race for governor because she didn't lose. But as she said, I didn't lose, but I wasn't inaugurated. That's all. And that can only happen with investigative reporting where you don't repeat the press releases and or become simply an empty chat room, blah, 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 you know, Trump's a Russian agent, Hillary has a bad hairdo today, blah, 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 what's the latest baloney rap that is non-informative and not uncovering the real information they want to hide from you. That's why I'm an investigator. I'm uncovering the information they want to keep from your eyes.
And let me quickly say, I read the story you wrote back in 2000 about the election fraud. It was in The Guardian. You were in London, I believe. I called you in
London.
I didn't know who you were. And I called you up and I said, hey, will you come on my radio show? And one of the things that you told me was you'd sent the information to CBS. You'd sent the information to NBC as well as ABC. And none of them would touch it.
That's right. In fact, CBS, you'll love this. Dan Rather and 60 Minutes wanted to pick up the story about how Catherine Harris had removed thousands of black folk. And I actually had the information that Jeb Bush his office was personally involved in illegally removing black voters from the voter rolls. And they said, fantastic story. And they They took it from me. I offered it for free. ABC had the rights to take it for free from BBC, my outlet. Remember, by the way, this story was the top of the nightly news everywhere in the planet except the United
States. Except the United States.
And so what happened was Dan Rather's operation, they didn't run it. They didn't run. I called them. I said, man, this is a vital news story. Remember, Bush had not been declared president. There was still the fight over the count of the vote. I said, Bush is going to steal this unless you reveal it. And it's not a matter of whether Bush or Gore should be president. It's a matter that people should choose. And their answer was, and you'll love this, and I'm quoting CBS, their top producer at 60 Minutes said to me, we've checked out the story. I said, how did you check it out? And it didn't stand up. What do you mean it didn't stand up? He said, we called Jeb Bush's office, and Jeb Bush denies it. That's it. Jeb Bush denies it. There it is.
And what you showed me the letter from Choice Point, the data gathering company that Jeb Bush's office had contracted with to purge the Florida voting rolls of convicted felons. Choice Point sent, I'm operating off of memory here, so please correct me. Choice Point sent Jeb Bush a letter saying, your database is corrupt. You have people being convicted of felonies in the future. And you had the letter from Jeb Bush back to Choice Point saying, delete those columns and continue your work.
In fact, they said we have 94,000 matches, but these names are mismatches. Like they had Billy, they had Billie Jean Jackson, and this, Billie Jean Brown. I'm not making this name up. Billie Jean Brown was supposed to be the same as Billy David Brown,
right?
And it's the same person. One was a man, one's a woman. Even
right.
There it is. You know, you had people completely mismatched, and the state said, don't worry about that. The important thing is that it said BLA next to their names. That is black. That report was public on the top of the nightly news, BBC, front page of the Guardian newspapers, and that's investigative reporting. But that was not what was done in the U.S. And what's happened is the Snowden revelations were vital. And I just want to remind you, it's only because the Guardian and Der Spiegel of Germany said they were going to publish the Snowden report that it embarrassed the New York Times and Washington Post into publishing the report. And that is one of the reasons why The Intercept was supposedly formed, so that there would be a group of investigative journalists who wouldn't be shut out by the mainstream media in the U.S., that there would always be a place for investigative reporters to report their work. So, you know, again, there may be things I don't know. The story that Omidyar, the billionaire, ran out of money, I don't buy that. But, you know, the last thing I want to do is say that the Intercept is a terrible news outlet, and that they are to blame here, because, after all, they have been the center of some really important investigative reports, and I don't want to take that away from them.
Mm-hmm.
What we haven't had, the Washington Post, yes, everyone goes back to the great Watergate investigation. I'm sorry, the Post has frankly not initiated a major investigative report now, when I hear about Watergate, for 40 years. For 40 years, we haven't gotten a major investigative report. Yes, they put out the Snowden stuff, but only because The Guardian was putting it out. They didn't originate that story.
Let's look at this in the context of the Russiagate story. Mainstream folks, Rachel Maddow and Joanne Reed and all these other people, they've spent more than 2 years telling us that the Mueller report would prove that Donald Trump is a Russian agent, that Donald Trump is guilty of treason, that Donald Trump is everything but a child of God. Now, Rachel still can't get the egg off her face now that the Mueller report has been released, and now they're flipping it. And now their rationale is, we have to release the whole report. We have to release the whole report. They still are sticking to the bit. Your thoughts?
Well, look, we've had some very good investigative reporters on this. And the Russia stuff has got to end. Donald Trump is a dangerous, bigoted, bloviating you know, malignancy on the presidency.
Bloviating, I like that.
Yeah, but he's not a Russian agent. You know, so it's like, you know, I mean, you can dislike let's report on the really important things. You know, there's been virtually no coverage on the fact that Trump is talking about removing $250 billion from the Social Security fund in his new budget. I mean, this is serious, serious stuff, okay?
Right.
Let's talk about the serious stuff and not the antics and Roger Stone and the antics. In fact, I remember Ari Melber calling my friend Randy Credico a liar when he basically said that Randy Credico was supposed to be the so-called go-between Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, and to Roger Stone, to Donald Trump, so that Putin gave WikiLeaks these documents, and this was handed off to the Trump campaign. This huge fantasy conspiracy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Randy Credico said, I had dinner with Julian Assange, and no, he never said Putin gave me these documents. This is silly, and I never gave anything to Roger Stone, who is a scamp, a liar, and a con man. And guess what? And while Ari Melber called Randy a liar, Mueller based an indictment of Roger Stone on the testimony of Randy Credico. And so the actual case that Mueller brought was, there was no conspiracy. Roger Stone lied when he said that he passed information from Russia via Julian Assange and Credico to the Trump campaign. In fact, the one big indictment that came out was the one that proved there was no collusion. It's not like, oh, we don't have the full report. No, we have the Stone indictment, which said he lied when he said he passed information from WikiLeaks to Trump. Russian information from WikiLeaks to Trump. So literally, Mueller went beyond saying there's no. I couldn't find evidence of collusion. He said, I found evidence of no collusion, strong evidence that there was not collusion. That's what that case is about, the Roger Stone case. That's what that indictment is. And yet, they won't let go of it. And, you know, this is. And the problem is it covers up real things. Yeah, did Trump steal the election? Yes. But not because he got some Facebook ads from some Russian oligarch for a couple bucks. No, it was stolen because of racial vote suppression, which the Democratic Party does not want to touch. That's not the issue that they are brave enough to take on, except finally, you know, Stacey Abrams, and let's make, you know, we all know that she is an African-American woman. Stacey Abrams has made that case to the public. She lost, and frankly, Hillary lost as well, because of the blockade and non-count of the African-American, Hispanic, American Native, and Asian-American vote. And I have the numbers, I have the documents, I have the evidence. That's all from investigative reporting. The question is, where are our outlets to put that out, as opposed to this embarrassing Russia, Russia, Russia stuff? It's just embarrassing. You know, Vladimir Putin said, yeah, of course I prefer Donald Trump as president. Hillary said she declared my nation an enemy. So that's his front, you know, out front political position defending his nation's rights. You know, whatever you feel about
right.
the guy or not is not the issue. But the idea that he fixed the election. No, I'm sorry. You know, I was asked, you talked about Joy Reid, who I really like. I think that she really tries very hard to stay to the facts.
Mm-hmm.
And she asked me on the air on MSNBC, was I afraid that the Russians would steal the election in Ohio by hacking into the machines? I said, no, I'm afraid that the Ohio Republican Party
right.
would manipulate this election. And they did. I have the stone cold evidence. I published it in Rolling Stone. That the Ohio, I said, I'm afraid because the Ohio guys have the passwords, they have the motive, they have the opportunity. Why aren't we talking about that? Why aren't we talking about that investigation? That was the last time I was on NBC at primetime.
Yeah, I was going to ask, when was the last time Joy had you on the show? And that answer would be never.
Well, she did many times, but again, it's kind of, I mean, between us and the people listening on the weekends when the executives aren't listening in. Look, I understand the pressure on these, on the people on places like MSNBC, CNN, et cetera, to push the Russia story. It's an embarrassment. My good friend, David K. Johnston, you know, he wrote a great book about Trump as a, he is a rolling crime spree, a one-man crime spree. And he really nailed the guy. And in his great book, he doesn't mention Russia at all, but yet he'll go on CNN and repeat the Russias. He literally said on one program, a week before the report, Donald Trump is a Russian agent. Now, I know he says these things. It gets him on air. I'm not going to get on CNN. He will get on CNN if he says those things.
Right.
And I understand, because maybe he says, well, then I'll sneak in some of the substance from my investigative, right, great investigative reporting. I'll sneak in the substance. I, as a matter of ethics, right, will not, you know, BS the line just to get a few minutes of airtime.
And final point, as an example of all of this, they love to talk about Mueller having indicted a group of Russians. And the interesting thing, when he indicted the folks from Concord Management and Consulting, they actually came to court. And when they came to court and asked for discovery, what did Mueller do? Well, he asked the judge for a protective order to prevent the delivery of the evidence that the lawyers for those indicted individuals would need. So,
well, you know, one thing Mueller did was, keep in mind, his indictments were not necessarily about collusion between Trump and Russia. It was, he had all these indictments involving, like, Manafort, et cetera, about not paying their taxes,
right,
fraudulent, fraud against the government, mail fraud, et cetera, which were all sideways things which had nothing to do with the so-called collusion. And, you know, guys, you know, what's interesting to me is a guy like Manafort, who was basically an open criminal.
Right.
When he was a major GOP operative, remember when he became Donald Trump's campaign manager, the mainstream media said, oh, finally, an establishment Republican, the adult in the room. They were praising his appointment as running the Trump campaign, the respected guy from the Republican Party. Now, he's now in prison, but for the good reason, but it had nothing to do with, you know, the Russians fixing the election. Let's get to the real issues.
It had nothing to do with his working for Mobutu. It had nothing to do with his working for Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines. None of that.
This is the end. And why weren't the stories about that? Why were the stories, again, it was all about, you know, and this kind of generalized McCarthyite stuff. Remember, I live in the district of Adam Schiff, Congressman Schiff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he's the new Joe McCarthy. You know, he's looking for Russians under every bed. I live in a district. His district has one of the biggest homeless populations in the United States. Congressman Schiff, please come home. Get off the Russian front. Take care of the homelessness in your district. Take care of the issues in where I live. Instead of hunting for phantom Russians, this is like Richard Nixon, you know, when he supposedly found the microfilm in the pumpkin. He wants to be Richard Nixon. He wants to find that microfilm in the pumpkin that Bruce, I mean, we look at it now as a cartoon. It's a laugh, but it
right.
was news then.
Right.
And it's the same thing. Schiff is pulling the microfilms out of the pumpkins, and there are no pumpkins. There is no microfilm. Knock it off, Congressman. Get to work. We're paying you to represent my district and the people in those tents outside my house.
Let me stop you there. Greg Palast. Go to gregpalast.com, folks. Go to gregpalast.com if you want to get some real information, some real journalism, some real news. Greg, thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour.
You got me. Bye.
My man. All right, folks. You're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We
are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Juan Guaido is set to enact uprising rooted in U.S. regime change operation manual. With its hands tied when it comes to military intervention, only covert actions such as those described in the Red Team document are likely to be enacted by the U.S. government, at least this stage of its ongoing regime change effort in Venezuela. What does this mean going forward? Well, we turn to my next guest. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. Daniel, as always, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me.
It seems as though the more days pass, the more intrigue, and I use that word deliberately, the more intrigue seems to develop around Juan Guaido and how he's going to figure out how to take over, with the U.S. support, the country of Venezuela. Give us some insight into your thoughts about his freedom aid committees, the freedom cells, and the cells that are going to spring into action on April 6th and launch large-scale protests in Venezuela.
Well, I mean, my thoughts are that this has been going on for a long time. It's dragging out, and that Guaido seems to have clearly lost the initiative. I can't rule out something happening on April 6th. You know, events down there are kind of opaque. But certainly his movement seems to be losing steam. The Venezuelan economy is still in big trouble. The country is deeply divided. But the U.S. is more desperate rather than less in terms of what to do. It just seems to have run out of answers. The Trump team is really clumsy and inept, and its efforts aren't paying off. So I'm just inclined to dismiss the importance of Guaido's latest call.
So we have blackouts, and the country gets cast into the depths of darkness, and Maduro comes out and says, the United States has cracked into our computers and has taken down our power grid. We don't have yet hardcore evidence to support that, but it does seem to be a page out of the U.S. playbook. Now we have reporting that on April 6th, Juan Guaido is going to launch his freedom and aid committees, and these stories are laying out how this is going to happen. It seems as though the United States isn't even really concerned anymore about the appearance of propriety. This really just seems to be just naked aggression, and we don't care how it looks. We're just going to do what we do.
Yeah, but it just seems to be more and more inept. I mean, yes, it is the kind of thing the U.S. would do. It certainly has, you know, Washington's hands all over it. But it just doesn't seem to be working. Guaido, I said, is just running out of steam. And the ineptitude of the Trump team is amazing. Pompeo, Bolton, Pence, they seem to be incapable of putting together a two-car funeral. So these guys just seem to be really blowing it in that country. And for the moment, events seem to be working in Maduro's favor.
But help me understand, if we put this in the context of the deep state apparatus, or we put this in the context of the intelligence apparatus, and we'll use that word advisedly, in the United States government, operations like this, historically, as far as I understand it, haven't really rested in the hands of the president. There are other folks who have been in this game a much longer time and whose tentacles reach much further than the president's can. So for example, bringing Elliot Abrams in on this. Well, okay, he's a player with a deep playbook, knowing how to get this done. My point is, this really seems, or usually historically, has been left to the hands of the operatives that truly understand how to play this game, instead of fools like Donald Trump and Mike Pence.
Yeah, that's totally true. I mean, guys like Abrams are old hands at this kind of thing. So is Bolton. But all I can say is, yes, they are old hands. I just don't want to exaggerate their skillfulness, because they just seem to be doing a really bad job in this case. And they're really, you know, they're the kind of enemy that I think that a Maduro, you know, thanks God on a daily basis for having. Because they make him look good. Americans often tend to exaggerate the power of the CIA. They assume it's more intelligent than it really is, but sometimes it can behave amazingly ineptly, and this is one of those cases. I mean, Venezuelans don't want to be invaded by a foreign country. They don't want to be recolonized by the United States. That is their least attractive option at this point.
How much of this do you think plays to technology and the fact that right now, for example, through the internet, through independent sources like Mint Press and The Intercept and other independent media sources, I can pull up this article, which Whitney Reb wrote, Guaido set to enact uprising rooted in the U.S. regime change operations manual. And then I scroll through and she writes, however, a document released by the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, in February and highlighted last month in a report by DevEx details the creation of networks of small teams or cells that would operate in a way very similar to what Guaido describes in his plan for Operation Freedom. Given that, Guaido was trained by a group funded by USAID's sister organization, the National Endowment for Democracy, and is known to take his marching orders from Washington, including his self-proclamation as interim president and his return to Venezuela following the humanitarian aid shutdown. So the point being that we now have sources, very credible sources, alternative sources, such as Mint Press, such as Radio Sputnik, that we didn't have in the 60s. We didn't have in the 70s. So now you and I can have this conversation real time over American media. We weren't able to disseminate this information 25 years ago.
Yeah, it's totally amazing. You're absolutely correct. We have a wealth of information now at our fingertips. So it's very easy to see what the U.S. is up to. But so clearly they're pushing Guaido in this direction. They want him to succeed. Are they engaging in sabotaging Venezuela's electrical network? It's very possible, although there's no conclusive evidence that that really is the case. So yeah, it's really amazing to have all this information at our fingertips. But I just must reiterate that the CIA is not as good as people often think it is. And in this case, for all its skill, for all its resources, for all its money, it's just really doing a bad job of regime change. And that's why Maduro is able to hold on despite really adverse circumstances.
I go back to a question that I've asked you a number of times, and I've asked a number of guests a number of times, because I think it is imperative that people listening to this program ask themselves this question: where is mainstream American media in telling the American people the real motivations behind what's being done here and why?
The American media, the mainstream media, the corporate media is nowhere. They have shown themselves to be so obsequious, such lapdogs when it comes to the U.S. government and especially the intelligence agencies. I mean, they have been led around by the nose by the intelligence agencies with regard to Russiagate, regard to Syria, the Ukraine, et cetera. They are little more than dictation machines. You know, the intelligence agencies speak and they dutifully jot it all down and write it up. But yeah, I think that what Trump is, what Bolton's ultimate strategy is to turn the entire continent, Central and South America, to the right by isolating the few remaining left-leaning regimes, Nicaragua, Cuba, and Bolivia, most particularly. I mean, Brazil, the giant of the continent, the second most populous country in the Western Hemisphere, now under a semi-fascist Bolsonaro. Colombia has gone far to the right. Now Venezuela, they're hoping, will go in the same direction. And if Venezuela does go in that direction, then their work will be three-fourths accomplished. It's unclear how much longer, for example, Ortega will be able to hold out in Nicaragua. So there's a big battle going on, a huge battle for regional control. So while their goals are quite clear, they just aren't, so far, they're not doing a very good job of achieving them.
And to your point, it's very important for people to understand what that really means, as Bolton was, Bolton, I think, was very clear in saying, we're starting in Venezuela, then we're going to Nicaragua, then we're going to Cuba. Folks really have to understand not only what that means philosophically or what that means theoretically, but practically, what are they potentially setting us up for?
Well, there were real bloodbaths in El Salvador and Guatemala in the 1980s. And Nicaragua had to, suffered under a U.S.-sponsored guerrilla war for years. I mean, if Cuba goes, that'll be a huge feather in Trump's cap. But there will undoubtedly be waves of repression and conflict that'll be unleashed on that island. So, yeah, I mean, events could turn really bloody really fast. But Bolton and Abrams and Pompeo are super aggressive, and they want to put together a continent-wide steamroller that will return Latin America firmly to the right.
And when people mention the Monroe Doctrine, that's now being bantered about, a lot of people scratching their heads. We weren't around when the Monroe Doctrine was first articulated, but this is a play from a very, very, very old American playbook.
Yeah, we know. To be fair to Monroe, Monroe is seeking to keep out British and French and Spanish imperial influence and out of the Western Hemisphere. But since the Spanish-American War, the doctrine has been reinterpreted to mean that the Western Hemisphere is now an exclusive U.S. playground, and that America is free to do whatever the hell it wants, and no one else dares say otherwise. This is ridiculous, obviously. But nonetheless, that is the course the Trump administration is pursuing.
Daniel Lazar, as always, sir, thank you for your time. Journalist and author, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Daniel, thank you so much for your time and always for your contribution to The Critical Hour.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks, you have been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out!